recorder. Recorder. Put the MP3 at the top on mic.
I'm a new faculty member in engineering, and I was a postdoc at Harvard for the last 5 years. So I'm glad to be at UCSD now. So they talk about solving cubic equations. You might remember solving quadratic equations from high school. For example, the equation x squared plus ax plus b, well, you have something called the quadratic equation, or the quadratic formula, which gives you the solutions, x equals, I've changed a and b from how you might have usually seen it. So these are the two solutions to that equation. This is something you might remember from high school. I'm sure you all remember from high school. Now, let's suppose you are interested in solving this equation, but you restrict yourself, and you demand that x be a rational number. You're not happy with just any solution. You want to know, is there a solution with x a rational number? Can you find a solution with x rational? It's a slightly harder question. If you just ask, is there a solution at all? Well, the answer is yes. The number might be complex, but you just write it down. There is definitely a solution. It's given by this formula. If you require that it's rational, well, then you have a potentially a difficult question. How do you know whether or not there's a solution? In this case, you can simply solve using this formula and look and see whether the answer is rational or not. Simply compute this and then check, is a squared minus 4 the square of an integer? Yes, please.
So I remember the discriminant should be a squared minus 4b.
Did I mess up? What do you think? Is it right or wrong on the audience? Right here. Now is it right or wrong? Okay, good. Thank you. And thank you, Naki, for pointing that out. So question, is there a rational solution or not? It's fairly easy to answer. You simply use the quadratic formula, you find the two solutions, and then check to see whether or not they're rational numbers. So you can solve quadratic equations in the rational, so you can find the solution. This constraint that the answer is irrational, that's the sort of constraint that number theorists often put on a problem. You write down pretty much any random equation involving variables and just exponents, no sines or cosines or anything, and then say, are there any solutions where the solutions are rationals or integers, and you've made a question in number theory. One very famous question of this form is the following. X to the n plus y to the n equals z to the n. That's an equation just involving algebraic operations. Let's specify what variables we allow. Say x, y, and z have to be positive integers. And let's say that n has to be greater than or equal to 3, also an integer. Question, are there any solutions? Conjecture at Fermat is that the answer is no, there are no solutions at all. And that's a very, very famous problem in Lebesgue theory. It's now a theorem due to Wiles that there are no solutions to this equation. It has no solutions. So this problem was posed in 1640 or thereabouts and then solved in 1995 by Andrew Wiles. This has no solutions. It's a theorem of Wiles. Wiles' proof of this is extremely complicated. It involves taking a potential, a proposed counterexample to this statement, a solution, and then constructing from it what's called an elliptic curve. So you suppose there is a solution, a to the n plus b to the n equals c to the n, then you use this solution to make a cubic equation, not a quadratic equation, but a cubic equation, namely this one, y squared equals x, x minus a to the n, x plus b to the n. This is a cubic equation in x, quadratic in y. Notice it's in two variables instead of one variable, but it's a cubic equation in two variables. And then he shows that this cubic equation has a bunch of remarkable properties, namely there's no possible way that it can exist. Hence, there couldn't have been a counterexample that is a solution to the Fermat equation. Hence, Fermat's conjecture that there are no solutions is true. That's just a rough sketch of on what he did. So stepping back to the title of my talk, Solving Cubic Equations, you might have seen at some point in your life Cardano's formula. You write down a cubic in one variable, there's an explicit formula similar to the quadratic formula, but more complicated, that gives you the three roots of that equation. So you can solve x cubed, a plus ax plus b equals 0. You can solve this using Cardano's formula for the cubic. That's not what I'll be talking about today. Instead of talking about solving a cubic equation in one variable, I'm going to ask a slightly different question. What about solving a cubic equation in two variables? And I'll introduce a little bit of background and some guesses about what the answer should be. In other words, how you should approach the problem of solving a cubic in two variables. And at the end, I'll lead up to the statement of a conjecture due to Bertrand Thornton Dyer that was chosen a couple of years ago by the Clay Math Institute as one of their $1 million prize problems. It's in basic number theory, it's the problem they decided to choose. They chose 7 problems from all of mathematics. And in algebraic number theory, the problem they chose is this question about whether, it's a question about solving cubic equations but in two variables. So let's just step back for a moment and consider a thing that you've seen a long time ago, Pythagorean's theorem. I'm going to show you in a minute that finding solutions to this equation, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, can be thought of as the question of finding solutions not to a quadratic equation in one variable, but to a quadratic equation in two variables. So you might be interested, as the Babylonians were thousands and thousands of years ago, in listing right triangles, all of whose side lengths are integers. Here's evidence that the Babylonians were in fact interested in this. This is a very, very old tablet, and on it there is a list of triples of integers that satisfy this equation. They're side lengths of a rational right, or they're side lengths of a right triangle. I mean, it's easy to make a right triangle so that the base and the height are both integers, but to make the diagonal an integer also, that's kind of tricky, because if you make just two of them an integer, then when you solve for the third, the c, take square root of a squared plus b squared, there's no reason that should come out to be an integer unless you very carefully chose a and b. For example, if you choose a and b to be 3 and 4, then when you solve for c, for the diagonal of your right triangle, you'll find that you get 5, which is in fact rational. And it's an integer, actually. So here, square root of 3 squared plus 4 squared, that's 9 plus 16, 25, so you get the square root is 5. But if you were to choose a different number here, like maybe, I don't know, like 2, then you might not be in luck. This might not be a perfect square. So if you used 2 instead, this is a right triangle, it's put 2 here and 4 here, then the hypotenuse is 4 plus 16 square root, which is square root of 20, which is 2 root 5. And that's not
an integer.
So a question presents itself, systematically list these like the Babylonians did. The Babylonians could do this, and here they actually list quite big solutions, much bigger than the ones that are listed on the left, in base 60, in these columns. Notice I've listed some other ones. How did I do that? How do you systematically list solutions in the integers to this quadratic equation a squared plus b squared equals c squared? There are lots and lots of them. It's different than here where you have only 2 solutions, or up to 2 solutions.
So here's a trick that allows you to do that. You simply draw a circle, the equation of the circle being x squared plus y squared equals 1. Then you find solutions, you find rational points that lie in the circle. That is, you find rational numbers x and y, so x squared plus y squared equals 1. And there's a systematic way of doing that. But once you find such a thing, then you can use it to write down a Pythagorean triple. You just take the equation x squared plus y squared equals 1. If x and y are both rational numbers, you clear the denominator, and then that gives you a Pythagorean triple. It gives you a triple of integers that are the sides of a right triangle
So here's a systematic way that cleverly allows you to produce every single rational solution to the equation x squared plus y squared equals 1. It's kind of similar to this over here. If you wanted all the rational solutions to this equation, you could use this formula. You get 2 of them, so you get up to 2 of them, and then you just check to see whether or not they're rational. So here, it also gives you all of them, except here it's a little different. There are infinitely many rational solutions to x squared plus y squared equals 1. It's not hard to find solutions to this equation if you don't require that x or y be rational. You could choose any value you want for y and solve for x. But that's not so good if you become a number theorist for a moment and require that x and y be rational, that they be fractions. Whenever I say rational, I always mean a fraction. So quotient of 2 integers. Things get very subtle when you start asking for rational solutions or integer solutions to equations. Actually, it's a theorem. It was one of the Hilbert problems, but it's a famous theorem that there's no algorithm that takes as input a system of polynomial equations over the integers, and outputs either yes, there's a solution, or no, there isn't. You cannot give such an algorithm. You can prove that there can be no algorithm for doing that. So in complete generality, the question of deciding whether or not systems of equations have solutions and the integers is very difficult, in fact, impossible. But if you restrict the class of equation that you consider, for example, just consider this equation, then you have some hope, because it's not a completely general equation. So here's how you solve this one. You take a known solution, namely minus 1, 0, which is right here in the diagram. That is a solution to x squared plus y squared equals 1. Then you take a line that goes through that solution and find the other point of intersection with the circle. That's the dot that's indicated in green. Now, if you make this line have slope t, where t is a rational number, then you can prove, as I will for you in a moment, that the second point, the green point, has rational coordinates. Hence, you have found, from your initial solution, another solution that also has rational coordinates. Now, here's why the second point is rational coordinates. You simply do the algebra. You write down the equation of the line, which is given right here, and you write down the equation of the circle, x squared plus y squared equals 1. You solve those 2 simultaneous equations. So you substitute, say, y into this equation right here. One of the solutions you find will be minus 1, 0. You'll find one other solution, and it's given by these 2 formulas. So the x-coordinate of the other solution will be 1 minus t squared over 1 plus t squared, and the y-coordinate will be 2t over 1 plus t squared. So if t is a rational number, isn't it the case that both of these are rational numbers? Yeah, because you're just taking, you have a rational number, you can just, there's no square roots that are going to magically appear when you take a quotient of 2 rational numbers. Nothing bad happens. So given one solution and a slope, you get another solution. And this way you can get tons and tons and tons of rational solutions to the equation x squared plus y squared equals 1. You just take any t you want, like you could plug in your social security number for t, put it here and put it here, you'll get a big x and y out, and if you try it, you'll find that they satisfy the equation. And in fact, you get everything this way. Take any rational solution at all, draw the line, put a green dot where that rational solution is, draw this line, and you'll find that it has rational slope. So as you vary t through all rational slopes, you get all solutions to the equation. There are infinitely many, but now we understand them. They're in correspondence with the rational numbers t. And by the way, to make a connection with Pythagorean triples, if your rational number is r over s, with that in lowest terms, just by clearing denominators here, you get this Pythagorean triple. And up to ordering, you get all the primitive Pythagorean triples. That is, all triples of integers, so there's no common divisor of all three of them, just by systematically running through the rational numbers in progress. So that's an example of solving a quadratic equation. We could consider slightly more complicated quadratic equations in two variables, such as 3x squared plus 4y squared equals 7. And you could ask again to do this procedure. Instead of a circle, you'll get an ellipse, but it works just the same way. Really, the big subtlety to this problem is deciding whether or not, in the first place, your quadratic equation even has a solution. For example, consider the quadratic equation x squared plus 19y squared equals minus 1. Does that have any solutions at all? Not in the real number. So it's definitely not going to have a rational solution. It doesn't have a real solution. That equation doesn't have any at all. So that one was fairly easy to show that it has no solutions. But you could imagine maybe another one like 197x squared plus 59y squared equals 3. And it's not clear to me immediately whether or not that has a solution. Fortunately, there are methods similar to looking in the reals and asking is there a solution that will work for any quadratic equation like this. There are, of course, questions about how quickly you can carry them out. But for this one, you can, for example, reduce modulo various primes and use information like that to determine either yes or no whether or not it has a solution. And that will always work if you know exactly what to do. So we can solve two-variable quadratic equations. You can decide whether or not there's a solution. I haven't explained that in detail. Once you decide that there is, well, if you decide there isn't, you're done. If you decide there is, you actually find the solution, and then you draw this line, and you get all the other solutions. So quadratic equations and two variables aren't too bad. So the next case is cubic equations. We already run into a major unsolved problem in mathematics. Okay, so I'm going to define an elliptic curve to be a cubic equation for which you have a point. Remember, even here there's a distinction with quadratic equations. You might have a point or you might not. A cubic equation may or may not, again, have a point. For example, I want to restrict to two variables for what I'm saying. So take the equation 3x cubed plus 4y cubed plus 5 equals 0. It's an equation, it's a cubic equation in two variables. It does not have any rational solutions. That's by no means obvious. It's actually, there's a very clever argument of Silmer which shows that this has no solutions. So I'll suggestively put a big x through it to indicate that has no solutions at all if x and y are required to be rational numbers. Does it have any real solutions? Any solutions for real numbers? Floating point, no, decimals. If you answer this question, the prize is that you get to hear the rest of my talk. So the question is, does this have any decimal solutions? Yes, okay, why? Perfect. Very good. You just choose something for y, like you said 0, I think, and then you just solve and you get x equals a cube root of something. And that works. So very good. Very good. It definitely has decimal solutions. It's really dumb. You just take any kind of random value you want for y and solve, and you'll get an x that works for most values of y. But for rational solutions, it's not trivial at all that you can show there are no solutions at all. This does not count as what's called an elliptic curve. An elliptic curve is a cubic curve for which you know there's a point on it. Here's an example of an elliptic curve. Y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x. This is an elliptic curve because it does have a rational solution. Can anybody think of one on that particular curve? A pair of numbers, x and y, that solve that equation and don't involve any decimals. 0, 0. Very good. So right there, this is a perfect graph of the curve. Right here at the origin, you have a solution to that equation. And the numbers involved in the solution are rationals. Eyeballing this graph, does it look to you like there'll be finitely many rational solutions or infinitely many rational solutions? Remember when I drew that circle, it turned out, not so obvious, that there are infinitely many solutions. All you had to do is draw a line of slope t, and you would find a solution by looking at the other point of intersection. What about this graph? Does it look like it goes through infinitely many rational points or not? Hopefully, you have no clue. I mean, you can't tell. You can't just look at the graph and tell. You can see a couple of points that it goes through. You can draw, it turns out, and I'll show you a bunch of points on this, that this equation does have infinitely many rational solutions. If you change the x to an x squared, the graph looks almost identical, but only has 5 rational solutions. So the graphs tell you absolutely nothing about how many solutions there are. It's very mysterious. Sometimes you have a lot, sometimes you don't. In any case, an elliptic curve is a cubic curve where you have a solution. The reason they're called elliptic curves is because if you write down arc length formulas for ellipses, this is something that was done in the 1800s, you discover that these sorts of curves pop up in trying to understand those intervals that come out of that. But that's not really what elliptic curves are used for anymore. The key thing that I remember is elliptic curve does not mean an ellipse. An ellipse, what's the degree of an ellipse? If you draw the equation of an ellipse, what degree is it? It's quadratic. It's degree 2. That kind of falls into the situation we were considering before. Now I'm considering elliptic curves and asking about their solutions. And this is really a cubic case. It's the case when you know you have a solution and the equation is cubic. Already I can tell you an open problem. Here's an open problem. Give an algorithm that takes as input a plain cubic equation. So this is an example of the sort of input that you would give it. You could involve cross terms. So it could be something like 3x cubed plus 17xy squared plus y minus x squared plus 7. That's a good example. Tell me, either yes or no, does this have any solutions in the rational numbers? Just yes or no. That is an open problem. There's no known algorithm that takes as input a cubic like that and then outputs either yes or no. There's a proposed algorithm, but it's not known to work. If you just ask about real solutions, or if you know about p-adic numbers, p-adic solutions, then you can decide either yes or no. However, there's no way, known way right now to decide yes or no for rational solutions, unfortunately. You can ask, is there a solution where x and y are real numbers? Or if you know about p-adic numbers, is there a solution for the p-adic numbers for all primes p? And there are examples of curves which have a real solution and also have a p-adic solution for all primes p, yet they don't have a rational solution. In fact, here's an example right here. So unfortunately, the understanding what happens over the reals and p-adically for all primes p is not enough to understand what happens. Okay, so remember, for a quadratic equation, there was a method. Given a solution, you could get a whole bunch of others. You can get all the others by drawing a line through that one solution and looking at the other point of intersection. Well, you can do something similar with a cubic equation, an elliptic curve. If you have two solutions, you simply draw the secant line, the line that goes that's determined by those two solutions, look at the third point of intersection. If the two solutions had rational entries, like they do here, that's the point minus 2, 0, that's the point 0, minus 2, then the resulting third point of intersection, as you can judge just by algebra, will have rational entries as well. It's 2 minus 3 in this particular example. So this is a procedure that I think Fermat introduced. That's a picture of somebody who probably looked kind of like Fermat. I don't think we have any paintings of Fermat. He was a French magistrate, and that's a French magistrate. So they probably all look kind of the same to us today. Curly hair. So here's a picture that illustrates how, given two solutions to an elliptic curve equation, a cubic equation, you get a third solution. But you kind of run out of steam if you do this. You can then take the third solution and this one, and you get back when you get this one. You don't get anything new after you get one more solution, which is kind of frustrating. You just get one more solution and that's it. Fortunately, there's another method, which is the limiting case of the one I just showed you, which is you pretend like the two points are the same. So you draw the instead of drawing the line determined by the two points, you draw the tangent line to the curve at those at that point, and then you get the other third intersection. Again, it has rational entries. The reason it has rational entries again is if you just do the algebra and write down an explicit formula for the third point of intersection, you find that it's, as before in the case of a quadratic, a rational function of the parameters. It's a rational function of the coordinates of the points that you started with, or in this case, the one point that you started with. So here, if you draw the tangent line at the point 0, 0, you get a third point of intersection, well, a second point of intersection, if you like, at the point 1, minus 1. So I'm finding lots of different solutions already. Now if you take the point 1, minus 1 and draw the tangent line, you get 2, minus 3, which is a point that's maybe a little more difficult to just see with your eyes. And then if you do that yet again, you draw the tangent line at 2, minus 3, and 21 over 25, comma 56 over 125. So that's a pretty complicated looking rational solution to the equation y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x, which is the one they'll consider always in this talk. Let me copy that onto the top of the board. Actually, I'll put it over here. So the equation I'm always considering is y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x. By the way, you can factor both sides. And notice that whenever you find a solution to this equation, you're finding a pair of rational numbers so that the product of somehow three consecutive ones is equal to the product of two consecutive ones, where consecutive means to add one to it. So if you wanted to find two rational numbers so that if you multiply that number plus one more and get the same thing as the other number plus one more plus another one more, then every time you find a solution like this, you're finding such a thing. So for example, I just pointed out for a minute.
So you can find more and more solutions.
You might wonder, if you keep iterating this procedure, draw the tangent line here, what do you get? Do you get really complicated solutions, or does it run out of steam?
Here's what happens.
So the next iteration gives you this point, and then the next iteration after that gives you this incredibly complicated point, which you'd be very unlikely to find just by directly searching if you didn't know to draw a tangent line. So
already, from what I've told you, you now have a clever way of constructing very large solutions to certain equations that many people probably don't know. To go back one slide for a second, all you do is take your cubic equation, draw the tangent line, find the next point of intersection, and if you iterate this procedure, you have a chance, if there are lots of solutions, to construct some really complicated ones, as I've done here.
Now here's a really amazing thing. If you combine the ideas I've showed you so far, you get an abelian group. So how many people here have ever heard of a group? Okay, good. So a lot of you have heard of a group. A group is a set such that if you have two elements in the set, there's a nice way of getting a third element in the set, and there are various axioms that are satisfied by this procedure.
So here's an example for you of a group. You take all the rational solutions to this cubic equation, you throw in one extra point, you think of it as being at infinity, and you call it the identity element of the group. And you take that collection of things all together.
So in this case, it's denoted, if the curve is called E, E for elliptic curve, then since the rational numbers are called Q, I erase the word rational. E of Q is the set of pairs X, Y, such that y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x. And then you throw in an extra point at infinity.
That forms an abelian group. Here's how the abelian group works. If you have two elements of that set, two rational solutions,
You get a third solution. Well, I already told you one way to do that. You just take this line determined by the two and find the third point of intersection. Unfortunately, that composition law, that way of combining two elements to get a third one, that doesn't satisfy the formal axioms of a group. However, you throw in one additional thing. You draw a line, a vertical line, and look at the other point of intersection. There'll be exactly one. Then that other point of intersection, you call that the sum of the red dot and the green dot. So red plus green is yellow. And in this case, you add together the point minus 1, 0 with 0, minus 1. You get the point, again, sort of a surprise new point, 2, comma 2.
And you get a group in this way.
Also, to add a point to itself, it's again the limiting procedure. You take the tangent line, look at the third point of intersection, and then reflect it vertically about the x-axis, and look at the other intersection point.
Well, you don't reflect it vertically, but you look at the vertical line and look at where it intersects the curve.
Just like that.
So now I've given you a way of, given any two points on a curve, you can get a third point, or given any one point, you can add it to itself and get a second point. Here's an example using, I'm writing a piece of software called SAGE, which stands for Software for Algebra and Geometry Experimentation. And you can construct in that program an elliptic curve. You can make a point on the curve, as indicated here. And then you can take multiples of the points, and you get more and more points sometimes. In this particular example, you get very large, surprising solutions. By the way, if you're interested in making a new, amazing piece of software for number theory and algebra and geometry computation, please contact me. I'd love to hire an undergrad or some undergrads to work on this. Anyone who's really into programming and has an interest in, say, Python programming in particular, and mathematics, might be able to contribute a lot to this project. So remember I told you that the graph of y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x goes through lots of rational points in the plane. And here are examples. So I took the point 0, comma 0. I have a group, so I can take 2 times it, 3 times it, 4 times it, and so on. I generated up lots and lots of solutions, and I've drawn a dot everywhere that I found a solution. These are the first 150 multiples of 0, 0. And you see that curve goes through lots and lots of different rational points. It turns out that the group is the cyclic group generated by 0, 0. You can get every single point on the curve. Every single rational solution can be obtained by taking 0, 0 and then adding it to itself enough times, or taking the negative of 0, 0 and adding it to itself a bunch of times. So the entire group is obtained in this way. That statement is difficult to prove. It's not at all obvious. And here's a remark. If you take this equation, I mentioned this earlier, y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x squared, very similar looking equation, that one has only 5 solutions. So the group's totally different. You have only a few solutions. And if you look at just random elliptic curves, you'll find that roughly half the time you have infinitely many solutions, and about half the time you have only a couple of solutions. So there's this distinction between the two cases. Open problem. Given an algorithm that takes as input an elliptic curve and outputs either yes, there are infinitely many solutions, or no, there are only finitely many solutions. We don't know how to do that either, unfortunately. So not only can we not decide whether or not a cubic in two variables has any solutions, but if you were to somehow know that it has a solution, you wouldn't be able to decide whether it has infinitely many or finitely many, or at least there's a procedure that seems to work in practice, but we don't know that it always works. So there's a problem there. But in any case, what's going on? How can you at least conjecturally decide between infinitely many and finitely many? There's a conjecture which does give a way to decide. It is something that you can carry out in practice. We just don't know that the conjecture is true. And that's essentially the million-dollar prize problem. Oh, let me reveal more Dell.
That's what Mordell looks like. So Mordell, he proved long, long ago, I think in the 20s, that this group is finitely generated. What that means is that if you write down any elliptic curve equation at all, any cubic equation that has a point, like the one I wrote down over there, well, we don't know how to find all the solutions. We don't know how to decide whether there are infinitely many. We do know something, though. We know that there's a finite list of points on the curve. We don't know what they are, but we know they're there. So you can get everything as just by combining together those finite number of points using the secant procedure and the tangent and the chord procedure I showed you before. In other words, using the group operation, you can get from that finite list of points to any given point on the curve. Every single solution will be got from some finite list. It's kind of like in linear algebra. In linear algebra, sometimes you have a vector space, and there's a finite list of vectors in the vector space, so everything else is a linear combination of that finite list. You say the vector space is finite dimensional. This is exactly the analog of that, but in the context of elliptic curves. It's saying that the group of points on an elliptic curve is finite dimensional. You don't have to worry that there's some incredibly prolific elliptic curve that has there's so many points on it that you can't even write down a finite list and get everything from that finite list of solutions. So you can always get all the points, or any given point, from some finite list. The problem is we don't know how to write down the finite list in the first place. The biggest, so a challenge is give a curve so that the number of points you need, the smallest number, is pretty big. And the biggest anyone's ever found is 24. This was found by some people at the National Security Agency about, 7 or 8 years ago. So just that I said that tells you that there's some connection between elliptic curves and cryptography, which I might say something about in a minute. Here's another example to give you a sense of how subtle elliptic curves can be. Here's a nice simple cubic equation in two variables, y squared equals x cubed plus 7823. This student, Jennifer Balakrishnan, she was a high schooler, and she asked for a Westinghouse science project, so I suggested find a rational solution to that cubic equation. And she tried very hard, and unfortunately, while she was trying to find a rational solution to that equation, this guy, Michael Stoll, who's world famous for his abilities to compute with objects like this, came up with a method that did allow him to find this particular solution. And moreover, he was able to prove that this is the simplest solution to that equation. There's no simpler solution. So, unfortunately, the simplest solution can be incredibly complicated, as you can see. But once you have that one solution, it turns out that all other solutions to the equation are multiples of that one solution. So you just take that one and you add it to itself over and over again. It's like a one-dimensional vector space. You add it over and over again, and you'll get all the other solutions to this equation. There are infinitely many, but systematically you can write them down one by one. You'll never write down all of them, but you know that given any solution, you'll hit it eventually. So, but in any case, you should appreciate the difficulty of trying to deal with these objects. I mean, look at the solution, it's huge compared to the curve that you start with. Actually, somewhat ironically, there's a theorem of Benedict Gross and Don Zagier, which in this particular instance gave an explicit formula for the solution. But the formula involves integrals and these complex, very calculus-like objects. And you can compute the x and y coordinates here, but only as decimals. And you have to compute them to really big precision to figure out what the rational numbers are. And unfortunately, people tried over and over again over the years with this particular curve, and no matter what precision they computed to, they weren't able to get these solutions. He used a completely different method than using the method I just mentioned. What he did was he wrote down another curve, which looked fairly complicated, but it had the property that if this has a point on it, then the other curve would have a point that maps to this point, and the other curve would have a much simpler point. So he then searched systematically for simple points in the other curve and found one. Then he took the image of that simple point and mapped it down and got this really complicated point. That's called the method of descent. It is called descent. So here's an old computer, and here are two old guys, very famous mathematicians. This is a computer that was at Cambridge University in England in the 1960s. And these two guys asked, this basic question, are there infinitely many solutions to an elliptic curve equation or not? Given an elliptic curve equation, which situation happens?
And I'm going to tell you what the result of them asking this question was. One was that this computer got an operating system. Swinnerton Dyer here told me that they didn't have a good way to actually run the computer, and in order to increase the chances he could get time on it, he wrote their first operating system. Then they let him use it a lot. And I'll tell you what he did with it. So Brian Birch, you can look up a paper he wrote in 1965, and he began the paper as follows. The subject of this lecture is rather a special one. I want to describe some computations undertaken by myself and Swinnerton Dyer on EDSAC, that's the name of the computer I just showed you, by which we have calculated the zeta functions of certain elliptic curves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Experimentally, we have detected certain relations between different invariants, but have been unable to approach proofs of these relations. So he looked at lots and lots of elliptic curves, did a lot of calculation, and discovered all kinds of amazing things, but couldn't prove any of it. So I'm going to give you a flavor of what they did. So if you start with an equation like this, you might get very frustrated trying to find or understand the solutions to it. You just stare at it and you're like, I can't see any solutions, or maybe you see a few and you don't know any more. This one, I already showed you a lot about it, but let me just write down a random one. Y squared equals x cubed plus 17x minus 389. I have absolutely no idea whether or not that has any solutions at all. It might have a small solution that I could latch onto and then use to make more solutions. I don't know. It's frustrating. It's very frustrating. What can you do? Well, here's a stupid thing you can do, which turns out to not be stupid at all. You can take, and instead of looking for x and y that are rational numbers that solve this, look for solutions modulo a prime number p. By that I mean, you look for pairs x and y that are integers, that are between 0 and p. You just fix some prime p, so 7. Let's just say 7. And don't require that these integer solutions solve the equation, only require that you have a congruence. In this particular example, y squared congruent to x cubed plus 17x minus 389 mod p. This congruence just means that the difference of the two sides is divisible by p. Or you take the left-hand side and reduce it mod p. So in the C programming language, you use this little operator. Or in math, you take the divide by p and take the remainder. You get the same number as if you do that on the right-hand side. So you could, there's no problem in finding all the solutions like that. You just mindlessly look through the 49 possibilities. And you check for each one whether or not it works. Of course, there are more intelligent ways, but in theory, it's not really that hard to list all the solutions. For example, if you're one of these gnomes from South Park, you can mindlessly spend your time finding all the points on this curve. So this is a graph of all the solutions to the equation y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x modulo 7. You take one of these dots, such as this dot at 2 comma 4, and check, you'll find that, so x is 2, that's 8 minus 2, which is 6, and y is 2, that's, well, that one's pretty obviously a solution, but any of the dots will work. So for example, 0 comma 6, x is 0 and y is 6. So if you plug in y equals 6, you get 36 plus 6, which is 42. If you take 42 and divide by 7 and take the remainder, what do you get? Shout really loudly, what do you get? Okay, excellent, you get 0. And so it works. Again, you have an equality there. That's all of the dots that you'll find if you look modulo 7. And you find that they're exactly 9. So if you get frustrated with trying to find solutions here, instead you can find solutions modulo p, and you can do this for lots of different primes p and see how many you get. Now here's where their guess comes. There's some bound here I won't go in. Well, just quickly, define ap to be p plus 1 minus the number of points modulo p. This is just a little notation, which I'll use in a second, I think. Here's another picture of Swinnerton Dyer, the guy who, one of the guys who initiated this investigation. And I was fortunate enough to see him sitting with a newspaper at a certain institute in Palo Alto, and the back of the paper says, stand and be counted, which is pretty appropriate because he spent so much time thinking about counting points on curves. So here's his idea. This is his guess, along with Swinnerton Dyer. You define a function associated to the curve. This function is nice because you can compute it without having to think very hard. And the function is given a number x, you take the product over all primes up to x of p divided by the number of points modulo p. And that's just some, for any particular value of x, you can figure out what this is. It's some rational number. And his idea was that will go to 0 exactly when the elliptic curve has infinitely many solutions. The heuristic reason for why that might be the case is that this p is going to be about size n of p on average. There's a proof of that. And if your curve has infinitely many solutions, it might drive up the number of solutions that you find here. You have all these solutions that are rational. That might make the number of solutions mod p a little bit bigger, because you have so many that you can reduce them. If you take the solution over the rationals, as long as p doesn't divide the denominator, you can reduce it modulo p, and you get a solution mod p. So his idea was that, on average, you have a little bit more solutions mod p exactly when the cubic equation, the elliptic curve equation, has infinitely many solutions. Here's some examples in SAGE of computing this function explicitly. So this is our running example where we do have infinitely many solutions. Something much more illustrative, I think, though, is graphs. So here's some graphs that I made. I took a whole bunch of different elliptic curves. I need to slide this sideways so you can see the equations. Okay. I took a whole bunch of different elliptic curves, and I graphed this function f sub e, which is at the top of the slide, on a logarithmic scale. These curves right here, this cluster down here, the graph is really low, whereas all these curves up here, the graph sort of stays away from the x-axis. Which curves do you think have infinitely many solutions? Which curves have finitely many solutions, based on the guess that I just mentioned to you before? So do you think this curve has infinitely many solutions or finitely many? So raise your hand if you think it has infinitely many solutions. Okay? Why do you think it has infinitely many solutions?
Because it's not going to zero.
Okay? So here's the heuristic again. If there are infinitely many solutions, that would make the n of p really big, which would make that denominator in the product tend to be big. Which would, what effect would that have on the product? It would make it sort of go to zero. So what do you think now? The other way, yeah. These probably all have finitely many solutions, according to the heuristic. These probably have infinitely many solutions. And in fact, that's true. For all these examples, everything up here, they have only finitely many solutions. All of these have infinitely many solutions. It works very nicely in practice. One thing is that it's a little bit frustrating, so I'm almost done. It's a little bit frustrating the way this function was defined. It's this infinite product, and it's very hard to understand from the point of view of calculus. So what you do instead is, remember a sub p was p plus 1 minus the number of points mod p. You make an infinite product, and this is a better infinite product because it makes sense for s's for lots and lots of different values of s. So you define a function. It's a somewhat complicated looking definition, but it's just a function that you get. It's kind of like a generating function. It's just a function that's defined from these numbers a sub p, which are obtained by counting points modulo p. And just to make it a little more concrete for you, here's a graph of that function for our particular example. And one thing, this function, as I've defined it up here, if you know about complex analysis at all, it has an analytic continuation to the whole complex plane. It's a very nicely behaved function. It makes sense no matter where you consider s. The fact that it has an analytic continuation is a consequence of the theorem Weyl's proved in the course of proving Fermat's last theorem. He proved that this cubic equation here was too complicated to exist. He proved that this curve would be modular. The fact that he didn't really just prove this curve is modular, he proved all elliptic curves, well, semi-stable elliptic curves are modular. Other people went on to prove all elliptic curves are modular. The fact elliptic curves are modular implies that that function has analytic continuation everywhere. Also note formally, if you stick s equal to 1 into the equation and multiply everything out, you end up getting just the product I considered before. So this is just a natural way of extending a function that that was not very well behaved to a very nicely behaved function. And that's a graph of it. Here's some other graphs of that function. And here's the conjecture, the million-dollar prize problem, which I'm going to almost finish my talk with. So the conjecture is the following. Take an elliptic curve over Q, define the function I just mentioned. It's defined in a somewhat complicated way. However, the definition really, all it involves is these numbers that you get by counting the number of solutions mod p. And consider that function at the point 1, which formally looks like considering the product p over n of p. That function at 1 is equal to 0, precisely when there are infinitely many solutions to the elliptic curve equation. That's the conjecture of Birch and Swinnerton-Dyer. Actually, they make it a little bit more precise. The order of vanishing at 1, which now makes sense because this function has nice analytic behavior, the order of vanishing equals the number of independent points you need to get all the points on the curve. It's like the dimension of the of E of Q. So that's just a slight refinement of the statement, the order of vanishing equals the rank. And in fact, this statement right here, the more precisely part, that's exactly the million-dollar question that the Clay Math Institute posed. If you solve the more precise the parenthetical question, you get $1 million in eternal fame in the Fields Medal. And, well, I don't know about the Fields Medal, but certainly a lot of fame. These guys, Kalivagan, Gross, and Zagier, proved a lot towards the theorem, and that's what I'll end with. They proved that if L of 1 is not equal to 0, if the function does not vanish at 1, and you saw in some of the graphs that sort of behavior, then E really has only finitely many solutions. So if you find a curve, you find that L of 1 is not equal to 0, you know it has only finitely many solutions. They also proved that if it does vanish at 0, but its derivative doesn't, then you have exactly one point will give you everything else. They didn't prove, though, that if you have only finitely many solutions, the function does not vanish at 1. So this is all they did. They just proved that under the hypothesis it's non-zero, you have finitely many. They didn't prove the converse. If the curve has infinitely many, you don't know that the L function does vanish at 1. So they proved, in some sense, half of the statement. And that is the end of my talk. So questions, comments, etc. are very welcome. Yes, please.
I kind of lost the train of thought when you were talking about what Wiles did.
Yep.
So he showed that the elliptic curve would have to be modular, but then you said that somebody else showed that all elliptic curves are modular. So how did he get a contradiction to the existence of this?
So he shows that it has to be modular. Ken Rubin showed that if this curve is modular, then it's modular of level 2. And there are no curves that are modular of level 2, as one can check by an explicit contradiction. And a bunch of people are Christoph Gray, Brian Conrad, Fred Diamond, and Richard Tisker. I think that would finish out the whole thing.
We have one more question, which is a more delicate question. Okay, so.
I didn't mention that at all. Wordle's theorem is that there are finitely many points needed to generate everything. The Wordle conjecture, which is actually a theorem, is that if you have a curve of degree bigger than 3, so I talk about two variables in degree 2 and degree 3, what about degree 4, 5, and higher? The theorem is that there are only finitely many solutions.
Thanks for
that's called the Wordle conjecture. So it would be natural to differentiate that, but unfortunately I didn't do the question.
Okay,
that's
great.
I mean, I had read over your slides before.
Is that our professor?
No, I didn't think so. But
it's a different pair.
I can imagine.
Ours is shared with beer. This is Benedict Gross, who's the dean of Harvard College now. He's a 10. But they have the same thesis. It was more fun than I talked about this at Harvard. Actually, he helped me. It's either infinite or a second group of participants.
Okay, that's what I was, so the so now let's say we get to this
point.
Now this is
okay, so you bring to this point plus this point about this talk. Then you could take
it's
Oh, yeah.
It answered that completely.
Yeah, I think so.